Kaylee sat bolt upright in bed. "Don't move another step," she said. "Guards?"
"We couldn't stop him," said the first guard, poking his head shamefacedly round the doorpost.
"He just pushed in," said the other guard from the other side of the doorway.
"And the wizard said it was all right, and we were told everyone must listen to him, because..."
"All right, all right. People could get murdered around here," said Kaylee testily, and put the crossbow back on the bedside table without, unfortunately, operating the safety catch. There was a click, the thwack of sinew against metal, a zip of air, and a groan. The groan came from Cutwell. Mort spun round him.
"Are you all right?" he said. "Did it hit you?"
"No," said the wizard weakly. "No, it didn't. How do you feel?"
"A bit tired. Why?"
"Oh, nothing. Nothing. No drafts anywhere. No slight leaking feelings."
"No, why?"
"Oh, nothing, nothing."
Cutwell turned and looked closely at the wall behind Mort.
"Aren't the dead allowed any peace?" said Kaylee bitterly. "I thought one thing you could be sure of when you were dead was a good night's sleep."
She looked as though she'd been crying. With an insight that surprised him, Mort realized that she knew this, and that it was making her even angrier than before.
"That's not really fair," he said. "I've come to help. Isn't that right, Cutwell?"
"Hmm?"
said Cutwell, who had found the crossbow bolt buried in the plaster, and was looking at it with deep suspicion.
"Oh, yes, he has. It won't work, though. Excuse me, has anyone got any string?"
"Help?" snapped Kaylee.
"Help? If it wasn't for you..."
"You'd still be dead," said Mort. She looked at him with her mouth open.
"I wouldn't know about it, though," she said. "That's the worst part."
"I think you two had better go," said Cutwell to the guards, who were trying to appear inconspicuous.
"But I'll have that spear, please. Thank you."
"Look," said Mort. "I've got a horse outside. You'd be amazed. I can take you anywhere. You don't have to wait around here."
"You don't know much about monarchy, do you?" said Kaylee.
No.
"She means better to be a dead queen in your own castle than a live commoner somewhere else," said Cutwell,
who had stuck the spear into the wall by the bolt and was trying to sight along it.
"Wouldn't work, anyway. The dome isn't centred on the palace. It's centred on her."
"On who?"
said Kaylee. Her voice could have kept milk fresh for a month.
"On Her Highness," said Cutwell, automatically squinting along the shaft.
"Don't you forget it."
"I won't forget it, but that's not the point," said the wizard.
He pulled the bolt out of the plaster and tested the point with his finger.
"But if you stay here, you'll die," said Mort.
"Then I shall have to show the disc how a queen can die," said Kelly,
looking as proud as was possible in a pink knitted bed jacket. Mort sat down on the end of the bed with his head in his hands.
"I know how a queen can die," he muttered. "They die just like other people, and some of us would rather not see it happen." "Excuse me, I just want to look at this crossbow," said Cutwell conversationally, reaching across them. "Don't mind me." "I shall go proudly to meet my destiny," said Kaylee.
But there was the barest flicker of uncertainty in her voice.
"No, you won't. I mean, I know what I'm talking about. Take it from me. There's nothing proud about it. You just die."
"Yes, but it's how you do it. I shall die nobly, like Queen Ezeriel."
Mort's forehead wrinkled. History was a closed book to him.
"Who's she?"
"She lived in Clatch, and she had a lot of lovers, and she sat on a snake," said Cutwell, who was winding up the crossbow.
"She meant to. She was crossed in love."
"All I can remember was that she used to take baths in ass's milk. Funny thing, history," said Cutwell reflectively. "You become a queen, reign for 30 years, make laws, declare war on people, and then the only thing you get remembered for is that you smelled like yoghurt and you were bitten in the..."
"She's a distant ancestor of mine," snapped Kaylee. "I won't listen to this sort of thing."
"Will you both be quiet and listen to me?" shouted Mort.
Silence descended like a shroud. Then Cutwell sighted carefully and shot Mort in the back. The night shed its early casualties and journeyed onwards. Even the wildest parties had ended, their guests lurching home to their beds, or someone's bed at any rate. Shorn of these fellow travellers, mere daytime people who had strayed out of their temporal turf, the true survivors of the night got down to the serious commerce of the dark. This wasn't so very different from Ankh Morpork's daytime business, except that the knives were more obvious, and people didn't smile so much. The shades were silent, save only for the whistled signals of thieves and the velvety hush of dozens of people going about their private business in careful silence. And, in Ham Alley, Cripplewar's famous floating crap game was just getting underway. Several dozen cowled figures knelt or squatted around the little circle of packed earth where Wah's 3 8-sided dice bounced and spun their misleading lesson in statistical probability.
3. 2 fowl's eyes by EO. He's got you there, Hummock. This guy knows how to roll his bones. It's a knack.
Hummock McGuck, a small flat-faced man from one of the hublandish tribes whose skill at dice was famed wherever two men gathered together to fleece a third, picked up the dice and glared at them. He silently cursed Wah, whose own skill at switching dice was equally notorious among the cognoscenti, but had apparently failed him, wished a painful and untimely death on the shadowy player seated opposite, and hurled the dice into the mud.
21 the hard way!
Wah scooped up the dice and handed them to the stranger. As he turned to Hummock, one eye flickered ever so slightly. Hummock was impressed. He'd barely noticed the blur in Wah's deceptively gnarled fingers, and he'd been watching for it. It was disconcerting the way the things rattled in the stranger's hand, and then flew out of it in a slow arc that ended with 24 little spots pointing at the stars. Some of the more streetwise in the crowd shuffled away from the stranger, because luck like that can be very unlucky in Cripplewar's floating crap game. Wah's hand closed over the dice with a noise like the click of a trigger.
"All the eights," he breathed. "Such luck is uncanny, mister."
The rest of the crowd evaporated like dew, leaving only those heavy-set, unsympathetic-looking men who, if Wah had ever paid tax, would have gone down on his return as essential plant and business equipment.
"Maybe it's not luck," he added. "Maybe it's wizarding?"
"I most strongly resent that."
"We had a wizard once who tried to get rich," said Wah. "Can't seem to remember what happened to him. Boys?"
"We give him a good talking to."
"And left him in Pork Passage."
"And in Honey Lane."
"And a couple of other places I can't remember."
The stranger stood up. The boys closed in around him.
"This is uncalled for. I seek only to learn. What pleasure can humans find in a mere reiteration of the laws of chance?"
"Chance? Don't come into it. Let's have a look at him, boys."
The events that followed were recalled by no living soul except the one belonging to a feral cat, one of the city's thousands, that were crossing the alley en route to a tryst. It stopped and watched with interest. The boys froze in mid-stab. Painful purple light flickered around them. The stranger pushed his hood back and picked up the dice and then pushed them into Wah's unresisting hand. The man was opening and shutting his mouth, his eyes unsuccessfully trying not to see what was in front of them, grinning.
"Throw!"
Wah managed to look down at his hand.
"What are the stakes?" he whispered.
"If you win, you will refrain from these ridiculous attempts to suggest that chance governs the affairs of men."
"Yes, yes, and if I lose?"
"You will wish you had won."
Wah tried to swallow, but his throat had gone dry.
"I know I've had lots of people murdered."
23, to be precise.
"Is it too late to say I'm sorry?"
"Such things do not concern me. Now throw the dice."
Wah shut his eyes and dropped the dice onto the ground, too nervous even to try the special flick and twist throw. He kept his eyes shut.
"All the eights. There, that wasn't too difficult, was it?"
Wah fainted. Death shrugged and walked away, pausing only to tickle the ears of an alley cat that happened to be passing. He hummed to himself. He didn't quite know what had come over him, but he was enjoying it.
"You couldn't be sure it would work?"
Cutwell spread his hands in a conciliatory gesture. "Well, no," he conceded. "But I thought, what have I got to lose?" He backed away.
"What have you got to lose?" shouted Mort.
He stamped forward and tugged the bolt out of one of the posts in the princess's bed.
"You're not going to tell me this went through me,"
he snapped.
"I was particularly watching it," said Cutwell.
"I saw it too," said Kayleigh. "It was horrible. It came right out of where your heart is."
"And I saw you walk through a stone pillar," said Cutwell.
"And I saw you ride straight through a window."
"Yes, but that was on business," declared Mort, waving his hands in the air. "That wasn't every day. That's different. And—" he paused.
"The way you're looking at me," he said. "They looked at me the same way at the inn this evening. What's wrong?"
"It was the way you waved your arms straight through the bedpost," said Kayleigh faintly.
Mort stared at his hand and then rapped it on the wood.
"See," he said. "Solid. Solid arm, solid wood."
"You said people looked at you in an inn," said Cutwell. "What did you do then, walk through the wall?"
"No. I mean, no, I just drank this drink. I think it was called Scrumble."
"Scumble?"
"Yes, tastes like rotten apples. You'd have thought it was some sort of poison the way they kept staring."
"How much did you drink then?" said Cutwell.
"A pint, perhaps. I wasn't really paying much attention."
"Did you know that Scumble is the strongest alcoholic drink between here and the Ramtops?" the wizard demanded.
"No, no one said," said Mort. "What's it got to do with—"
"No," said Cutwell slowly. "You didn't know.
That's a clue, isn't it?"
"Has it got anything to do with saving the princess?"
"Probably not. I'd like to have a look in my books, though."
"In that case, it's not important," said Mort firmly. He turned to Kayleigh, who was looking at him with the faint beginnings of admiration.
"I think I can help," he said. "I think I can lay my hands on some powerful magic. Magic will hold back the dome, won't it, Cutwell?"
"My magic won't. It'd have to be pretty strong stuff. And I'm not sure about it even then. Reality is tougher than—"
"I shall go," said Mort. "Until tomorrow, farewell."
"It is tomorrow," Kayleigh pointed out.
Mort deflated slightly.
"All right, tonight then," he said, slightly put out, and added, "I will be gone."
"Be gone what?"
"It's hero talk," said Cutwell kindly. "He can't help it."
Mort scowled at him and smiled bravely at Kayleigh and walked out of the room.
"He might have opened the door," said Kayleigh, after he had gone.
"I think he was a bit embarrassed," said Cutwell. "We all go through that stage."
"What, of walking through things?"
"In a manner of speaking. Walking into them, anyway."
"I'm going to get some sleep," Kayleigh said. "Even the dead need some rest. Cutwell, stop fiddling with that crossbow, please. I'm sure it's not wizardly to be alone in a lady's boudoir."
"Hmm? But I'm not alone, am I? You're here."
"That," she said, "is the point, isn't it?"
"Oh, yes, sorry. I'll see you in the morning, then."
"Good night, Cutwell. Shut the door behind you."
The sun crept over the horizon, decided to make a run for it, and began to rise. But it would be some time before its slow light rolled across the sleeping disk, herding the night ahead of it, and nocturnal shadows still ruled the city. They clustered now around the Mended Drum in Filigree Street, foremost of the city's taverns. It was famed not for its beer, which looked like maiden's water and tasted like battery acid, but for its clientele. It was said that if you sat long enough in the drum, then sooner or later every major hero on the disc would steal your horse. The atmosphere inside was still loud with talk and heavy with smoke, although the landlord was doing all those things landlords do when they think it's time to close, like turning some of the lights out, wind up the clock, put a cloth over the pumps, and just in case, check the whereabouts of their club with the nails hammered in it. Not that the customers were taking the slightest bit of notice, of course. To most of the drum's clientele, even the nailed club would have been considered a mere hint. However, they were sufficiently observant to be vaguely worried by the tall, dark figure standing by the bar and drinking his way through its entire contents. Lonely, dedicated drinkers always generate a mental field which ensures complete privacy, but this particular one was radiating a kind of fatalistic gloom that was slowly emptying the bar. This didn't worry the barman, because the lonely figure was engaged in a very expensive experiment. Every drinking place throughout the multiverse has them, those shelves of weirdly shaped, sticky bottles that not only contain exotically named liquid, which is often blue or green, but also odds and ends that bottles of real drink would never stoop to contain, such as whole fruits,
bits of twig, and in extreme cases, small drowned lizards. No one knows why barmen stock so many, since they all taste like treacle dissolved in turpentine. It has been speculated that they dream of a day when someone will walk in off the street unbidden and ask for a glass of peach corniche with a hint of mint, and overnight the place will become somewhere to be seen at. The stranger was working his way along the row.
"What is that green one?"
The landlord peered at the label.
"It says it's melon brandy," he said doubtfully. "It says it's bottled by some monks to an ancient recipe," he added.
"I will try it."
The man looked sideways at the empty glasses on the counter, some of them still containing bits of fruit salad, cherries on a stick, and small paper umbrellas.
"Are you sure you haven't had enough?" he said.
It worried him vaguely that he couldn't seem to make out the stranger's face. The glass with its drink crystallizing on the sides disappeared into the hood and came out again empty.
"No. What is the yellow one with the wasps in it?"
"Spring cordial, it says. Yes?"
"Yes. And then the blue one with the gold flecks?"
Old overcoat?"
"Yes. And then the second row."
Which one did you have in mind?"
"All of them."
The stranger remained bolt upright, the glasses with their burdens of syrup and assorted vegetation disappearing into the hood on a production line basis.
"This is it," the landlord thought. "This is style. This is where I buy a red jacket and maybe put some monkey nuts and a few gherkins on the counter. Get a few mirrors round the place. Replace the sawdust."
He picked up a beer-soaked cloth and gave the woodwork a few enthusiastic wipes, spreading the drips from the cordial glasses into a rainbow smear that took the varnish off. The last of the usual customers put on his hat and staggered out, muttering to himself.
"I don't see the point," the stranger said.
"Sorry?"
"What is supposed to happen?"
"How many drinks have you had?"
47.
"Just about anything, then," said the barman, and because he knew his job and knew what was expected of him when people drank alone in the small hours, he started to polish a glass with the slops cloth and said, "Your lady thrown you out, then, has she?"
"Pardon?"
"Drowning your sorrows, are you?"
"I have no sorrows."
"No, of course not. Forget I mentioned it."
He gave the glass a few more wipes. "Just thought it helps to have someone to talk to," he said. The stranger was silent for a moment, thinking. Then he said,
"You want to talk to me?"
"Yes, sure. I'm a good listener."
"No one ever wanted to talk to me before."
"That's a shame."
"They never invite me to parties, you know. They all hate me. Everyone hates me. I don't have a single friend."
"Everyone ought to have a friend," said the barman sagely.
"I think..."
"Yes?"
I think I could be friends with the green bottle."
The landlord slid the octagon bottle along the counter. Death took it and tilted it over the glass. The liquid tinkled on the rim.
"You drunk, I'm think, don't you?"
"I serve anyone who can stand upright best out of three," said the landlord.
"You're absolutely right, but I..."
The stranger paused, one declamatory finger in the air.
"Was what I saying?"
"You said I thought you were drunk."
"Ah, yes, but I can be a sober any time I like. This is an experiment, and now would I like to experiment with the orange brandy again?"
The landlord sighed and glanced at the clock. There was no doubt that he was making a lot of money, especially since the stranger didn't seem inclined to worry about overcharging or short change. But it was getting late. In fact, it was getting so late that it was getting early. There was also something about the solitary customer that unsettled him. People in the Mended Drum often drank as though there was no tomorrow, but this was the first time he'd actually felt they might be right.
"I mean, what have I got to look forward to? Where's the sense in it all? What is it really all about?"
"Can't say, my friend, except you'll feel better after a good night's sleep."
"Sleep, sleep, I never sleep. I'm What's name? Proverbial for it.
Everyone needs their sleep, even me, he hinted.
They all hate me, you know.
Yes, you said, but it's 3:15. The stranger turned unsteadily and looked around the silent room.
There's no one in the place but you and I, he said.
The landlord lifted up the flap and came around the bar, helping the stranger down from his stool.
I haven't got a single friend. Even cats find me amusing.
A hand shot out and grabbed a bottle of Amanita liqueur before the man managed to propel its owner to the door, wondering how someone so thin could be so heavy.
I don't have to be drunk, I said. Why do people like to be drunk?
Is it fun?
Helps them forget about life, old chap. Now, just you lead there while I get the door open.
Forget about life. Ah.
You come back any time you like, you hear?
You'd really like to see me again?
The landlord looked back at the small heap of coins on the bar. That was worth a little weirdness. At least this one was a quiet one, and seemed to be harmless.
Oh, yes, he said, propelling the stranger into the street and retrieving the bottle in one smooth movement.
Drop in any time. That's the nicest thing.
The door slammed on the rest of the sentence. Isabel sat up in bed. The knocking came again, soft and urgent. She pulled the covers up to her chin.
Who is it?
She whispered.
It's me, Mort,
came the hiss under the door.
Let me in, please. Wait.
Isabel scrambled frantically on the bedside table for the matches, knocking over a bottle of toilet water and dislodging a box of chocolates that was now mostly discarded wrappers. Once she'd got the candle alight, she adjusted its position for maximum effect, tweaked the line of her nightdress into something more revealing, and said,
It's not locked.
Mort staggered into the room, smelling of horses and frost and scumble.
I hope, said Isabel archly, that you have not forced your way in here in order to take advantage of your position in this household.
Mort looked around him. Isabel was heavily into frills. Even the dressing-room table seemed to be wearing a petticoat. The whole room wasn't so much furnished as lingerie'd.
Look, I haven't got time to mess around, he said. Bring that candle into the library, and for heaven's sake put on something sensible. You're overflowing.
Isabel looked down, and then her head snapped up.
Well!
Mort poked his head back round the door.
It's a matter of life and death, he added, and disappeared.
Isabel watched the door creak shut after him, revealing the blue dressing gown with the tassels that Death had thought up for her as a present, last Hogswatch, and which she hadn't the heart to throw away, despite the fact that it was a size too small and had a rabbit on the pocket. Finally, she swung her legs out of bed, slipped into the shameful dressing gown, and padded out into the corridor. Mort was waiting for her.
"Won't Father hear us?" she said.
"He's not back. Come on."
"How can you tell?"
"The place feels different when he's here. It's like the difference between a coat when it's being worn and when it's hanging on a hook. Haven't you noticed?"
"What are we doing that's so important?"
Mort pushed open the library door, a gust of warm, dry air drifted out, and the door hinges issued a protesting creak.
"We're going to save someone's life," he said. "A princess, actually."
Isabel was instantly fascinated.
"A real princess? I mean, can she feel a pea through a dozen mattresses?"
"Can she..."
Mort felt a minor worry disappear.
"Oh, yes. I thought Albert had got it all wrong.
Are you in love with her?"
Mort came to a standstill between the shelves, aware of the busy little scritchings inside the book covers.
"It's hard to be sure," he said. "Do I look it?"
"You look a bit flustered. How does she feel about you?"
"Don't know."
"Ah,"
said Isabel knowingly, in the tones of an expert.
"Unrequited love is the worst kind. It's probably not a good idea to go taking poison or killing yourself, though," she added thoughtfully. "What are we doing here? Do you want to find her book and see if she marries you?"
"I've read it, and she's dead," said Mort. "But only technically. I mean, not really dead."
"Good. Otherwise, that would be necromancy. What are we looking for?"
"Albert's biography."
"What for? I don't think he's got one."
"Everyone's got one."
"Well, he doesn't like people asking personal questions. I looked for it once, and I couldn't find it. Albert by itself isn't much to go on."
Why is he so interesting? Isabel lit a couple of candles from the one in her hand and filled the library with dancing shadows.
I need a powerful wizard, and I think he's one.
What, Albert?
Yes, only we're looking for Alberto Malik. He's more than 2,000 years old, I think.
What? Albert?
Yes, Albert.
He never wears a wizard's hat, said Isabel doubtfully.
He lost it. Anyway, the hat isn't compulsory. Where do we start looking?
Well, if you're sure, the stack, I suppose. That's where Father puts all the biographies that are more than 500 years old. It's this way.
She led the way past the whispering shelves to a door set in a cul-de-sac. It opened with some effort, and the groan of the hinges reverberated around the library. Mort fancied for a moment that all the books paused momentarily in their work just to listen. Steps led down into the velvet gloom. There were cobwebs and dust, and air that smelled as though it had been locked in a pyramid for 1,000 years.
"People don't come down here very often," said Isabel. "I'll lead the way."
Mort felt something was owed.
"I must say," he said, "you're a real brick."
"You mean pink, square and dumpy? You really know how to talk to a girl, my boy."
"Mort," said Mort, automatically. The stack was as dark and silent as a cave deep underground. The shelves were barely far enough apart for one person to walk between them, and towered up well beyond the dome of candlelight. They were particularly eerie because they were silent. There were no more lives to write. The books slept. But Mort felt that they slept like cats, with one eye open. They were aware.
"I came down here once," said Isabel, whispering. "If you go far enough along the shelves, the books run out, and there's clay tablets, and lumps of stone, and animal skins, and everyone's called Ugg and Zog."
The silence was almost tangible. Mort could feel the books watching them as they tramped through the hot, silent passages. Everyone who had ever lived was here somewhere, right back to the first people that the gods had baked out of mud or whatever. They didn't exactly resent him. They were just wondering about why he was here.
"Did you get past Ugg and Zog?" he hissed. "There's a lot of people would be very interested to know what's there."
"I got frightened. It's a long way and I didn't have enough candles."
"Pity."
Isabel stopped so sharply that Mort cannoned into the back of her.
"This would be about the right area," she said. "What now?"
Mort peered at the faded names on the spines.
"They don't seem to be in any order," he moaned.
They looked up. They wandered down a couple of side alleys. They pulled a few books off the lowest shelves at random, raising pillars of dust.
"This is silly," said Mort at last. "There is millions of lives here. The chances of finding his are worse than..."
Isabel laid her hand against his mouth.
"Listen."
Mort mumbled a bit through her fingers, and then got the message. He strained his ears, striving to hear anything above the heavy hiss of absolute silence. And then he found it. A faint, irritable scratching. High, high overhead, somewhere in the impenetrable darkness on the cliff of shelves, a life was still being written. They looked at each other, their eyes widening. Then Isabel said,
"We passed a ladder back there, on wheels."
The little casters on the bottom squeaked as Mort rolled it back. The top end moved too, as if it was fixed to another set of wheels somewhere up in the darkness.
"Right," he said. "Give me the candle, and..."
"If the candle's going up, then so am I," said Isabel firmly. "You stop down here and move the ladder when I say, and don't argue."
"It might be dangerous up there," said Mort gallantly.
"It might be dangerous down here," Isabel pointed out. "So I'll be up the ladder with the candle, thank you."
She set her foot on the bottom rung, and was soon no more than a frilly shadow outlined in a halo of candlelight that soon began to shrink. Mort steadied the ladder and tried not to think of all the lives pressing in on him. Occasionally a meteor of hot wax would thump onto the floor beside him, raising a crater in the dust. Isabel was now a faint glow far above, and he could feel every footstep as it vibrated down the ladder. She stopped. It seemed to be quiet for a long time. Then her voice floated down, deadened by the weight of silence around them.
"Mort, I've found it."
"Good, bring it down."
"Mort, you were right."
"Okay, thanks. No, bring it down."
"Yes, Mort, but which one?"
"Don't mess about. That candle won't last much longer."
Mort!
What?
Mort, there's a whole shelf!
Thank you.